Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 19, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at economics and politics. And actually, a lot of culture in the mix tonight. Well, the first segment will be about architecture in the Middle East and urban design and the role of the built environment in as a struggle, as something that's struggled over, but also as a way of exercising domination. We'll speak with two people. First, A.L. Weissman, who is an architect and organizer of an exhibition that was not allowed to be put up in Israel, The Politics of Israeli Architecture. And then we'll also be joined in the studio by Daniel Monk, who is the author of the book An Aesthetic Occupation, which is from Duke University Press, a study of how architecture has been, and buildings and sacred grounds have been interpreted, and their influence over the politics of the region over the last century or so. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, and he's been on the show before to talk about the domestic scene in Iran. We'll also ask him about what it's like for the country to be identified as part of the axis of evil, and what may happen as a result of any likely war against Iraq, what would happen in Iran. Before we get to that, just a couple of items. I adopted a practice from Bill O'Reilly, the amusing but often obnoxious host of the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News. He's got a feature in his show, The Most Ridiculous Item of the Day, and I had done a Most Ridiculous Item of the Week. Fell off the practice for a couple of weeks, but now I think I'm back. And I was going to do this item as a kind of ridiculous item, just because it's kind of funny. Press release came out the other day. Berkeley City Council becomes the first city on Earth to pass a resolution to declare the space above Berkeley to be a space-based weapons-free zone. Now, really, I don't think the weapons are going to listen. I don't think the a resolution passed by the city of Berkeley is going to have much effect on national security policy. And it's especially funny coming out of Berkeley, which is the site of a major nuclear weapons laboratory, the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. So if they could do something about the nuclear weapons on the ground before they start passing ineffectual resolutions about nuclear weapons in space, that might be a good thing. More seriously, another ridiculous item came out today, ridiculous in the sense of deserving ridicule. Chronicle of Higher Education's website reported today that a group called the Middle East Forum, which it is attempting to combat what it sees as anti-Israel bias in the academy, has put up a website that names some professors who are evil in their eyes, enemies of all that's good and true. And at least two of the people they name have been guests on this show, including Hamid Dabashi, who will be here in less than half an hour. Also, Sarah Roy, an economist at Harvard who studies the Palestinian economy, and she was censured for having the nerve to say that the Israeli occupation had had a negative effect on the Palestinian economy and might have promoted unemployment and poverty, which is, of course, self-evidently ludicrous, I guess. But anyway, they're asking people to rat on their professors on this website. We'll ask Hamid Dabashi what it's like to be identified as one of these people. But really, these people, this is just a most shameful sort of McCarthyism. And it's ridiculous in a very non-amusing way. And now we're joined on the line, speaking to us from Israel, A.L. Weissman, who is an architect, and co-organizer of an exhibition, The Politics of Israeli Architecture. It was written up in an unusually intelligent article in the New York Times over the summer, and the exhibition was not allowed to happen. Its funders really didn't like it because it was a little too critical. So we'll ask him about the history of that and also about the substance of the exhibition was all about. We're not talking about the pure aesthetic angle of architecture, but the politics of buildings and development and the physical manifestations of political and social relations. Are you on the line with us, A.L. Weissman? Can you hear us?
Yes, hello, Doug. Yeah, I can hear you very well.
Okay, good. Welcome to WBAI. First of all, tell us about what happened to your exhibition and the catalog that went with it. It was not allowed to happen.
Well, we were around last December, we won a competition to represent Israel in the International Exhibition of Architecture in Berlin. And we got the commission to make a quite a critical examination of Israeli architecture. I mean, that was kind of within our brief. We called the exhibition then the Settlement Instinct, and we planned to show how Israeli settlements, how building practice in Israel was, in a sense, kind of used as the executive arm of Zionism, in a sense, of Israeli policy in the West Bank. It was rather strange that we've won it in the first place, given the kind of a quite straightforward critical approach that we were proposing. But we got to go ahead, and we're trying to raise money for the exhibition as we started our research. It was quite difficult to raise money for an exhibition like that, and we got a situation that about a month before the exhibition was supposed to open, we were still without any budget. At that point, the Association of Architects, who commissioned that exhibition, approached the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Culture to try and finance it. When they became involved, they came to our office one day, and they wanted to see what it's all about. When they saw it, they go, "Oh my God! I mean, this is this was far too critical." In their opinion, they put pressure on the Association of Architects, who withdrew their support, canceled the exhibition, and took all 5,000 catalogs that were printed and held them. So the exhibition never was never exhibited in Berlin. And instead of it, they've put an exhibition that they've shown before of kind of nice Israeli architecture in kind of in and around Tel Aviv.
So, yeah, you mentioned somewhere.
Sorry.
You mentioned somewhere in the catalog, which you were kind enough to send me a copy of, that this is a, the official architecture. They want to talk about the local manifestation of Bauhaus style architecture and not really talk about more political and social aspects of it, right?
Sure. There is a kind of almost a fictional aspect in a way that kind of the history of Israeli architecture would like. Kind of to see itself and write itself. I mean, everybody's speaking about the white city, the history of Bauhaus, etc., which is, I dare say, almost an irrelevant part of Israeli architectural history. I mean, I think, frankly, or to be precise, there were perhaps three Bauhaus graduates that were acting in Tel Aviv during this time. And somehow the political aspect of Israeli architecture, the rural Israeli architecture, was somehow much more. I mean, that's the main story, and that's a story that was kind of hidden or camouflaged for many years somehow.
Now, in the catalog you sent me, there are a lot of things that are crossed out. Are these people who no longer wish to be associated with it, or why are these names crossed out?
Yeah, and well, we are now kind of in some sort of legal entanglement, and we are under legal caution not to show the catalog in any with any reference to the association and association members. So we have to cross out every name of an association member in it.
Okay. So now let's get to the substance of it. I mean, we're talking about the creation of a country that involved a lot of displacement, a lot of new building. What are you talking about when you're talking about the politics of Israeli architecture exactly?
Well, I mean, I think that what kind of makes Israeli planning very unique is that it was never meant to serve what is normally kind of the considerations of architecture, the well-being of citizens, etc., the flow of infrastructure, just very kind of mundane things that architecture usually deals with. I mean, it was meant from the start to create borders, to extend the frontier, to replace one geography, one cartography with another. So in a sense, from the start, it had kind of strategical, geopolitical bearings on the kind of formation of the state and of its borders. That is on the kind of on a regional scale. On a local scale, it was always, you know, it had to both dominate and protect itself in an environment that was always hostile to it. So particular forms and organizations of planning developed as a result of it. But, you know, I mean, they always there is historical precedence to kind of rural frontier-like settlements, even in the American West. But the kind of the particularity of the terrain and the particularity of the conflict created very very distinct forms of organization that they could be seen very clearly when you look at plans and on maps.
One of the essays in this catalog is about, sorry, I can't pronounce this correctly, Homa Umangdal?
Yes, yes, that's
yeah, could you tell the story of what that is almost prototypical of what would become a very widespread practice decades later?
Sure. That's an article by Sharon Rothbard, who is as well going to be now the publisher of the catalog when it's coming out soon. He was writing about... kind of a form of a typology of settlement that developed during the times of the Arab Revolt in Palestine in the late 20s, early 30s. These were kind of paramilitary outposts that were built in on areas that were purchased by, let's say, by the kind of Zionist organization, but it was impossible to settle because they were under threat of local Arab-Palestinian population. Basically, they were kind of surrounding themselves with a wall and building a tower to both signal to from one of those settlements to the other and to kind of to observe the landscape around it. And somehow, the from then on, the kind of both the function of the wall and the function of the tower, through different transformation, through different mutations, are still present in of contemporary settlement outpost building. I mean, in a sense, the tower as a kind of a control through vision, the function of the eye as a kind of a device to organize space, to control space, and the wall as a kind of a fortification organization in settlements that is, till these days, you know, Israeli settlements now are starting to surround themselves with fences again.
And gated communities.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a sense, you know, kind of the history of Jewish settlements in the West Bank corresponds quite neatly with the kind of the other tendencies, for example, in America, like gated communities and you know, enclave neighborhoods, new urbanism, etc. Kind of the escape of the upper middle class or middle class from the urban centers to the periphery and kind of enclosing itself in homogeneous communities. That happened in America in the 80s. That happened here in the 80s, in the early 80s. I mean, in a sense, there are corresponding principles between Israeli architecture there and kind of what's happening globally. But obviously, I mean, if you say that the West Bank is operating according to similar organizational patterns, you would say it is perhaps a laboratory, but it's a very extreme one. I mean, it's one where kind of the when kind of the meeting point between First World and Third World are done in a very very extreme way. I mean, it's taken kind of the suburban American suburban mentality, perhaps, to a violent, very, very violent extreme,
and defended with the language of quality of life, right?
Excuse me.
And explained by reference to phrases like the quality of life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a way of kind of getting the settlers into the West Bank was always. I mean, there were always two strategies. One was kind of to sell better quality of life, meaning. Very, very cheap land and huge subsidies on both on development and on income tax, for example, in the West Bank that kind of improved the quality of life of many kind of young couples that, that were escaping there. I think perhaps 80% of settlers are what we refer to as quality of life settlers. These are people who will leave the settlements if they are given enough compensation for it. But obviously the aim to put them there was the aim of the state. And when you read today, like brochures and you know, like advertisement to move to the settlements, I mean, these are hilarious. I mean, they're promoting kind of almost idyllic lifestyle in an area which is perhaps the most dangerous place on Earth now.
I want to return to this in a bit, but let's turn to the guest in the studio here. Daniel Monk, who is the author of the book An Aesthetic Occupation, The Immediacy of Architecture in the Palestine Conflict, published by Duke University Press, and he's a professor of art and architecture at SUNY Stony Brook and also teaches at the Harvard School of Design. Well, let's take a historical view of things here. The current phase, the Intifada, is named after a mosque. That this has been a site that's been under disputed for quite a long time, decades, century. Could you give us some of the history of how this came to be such a central issue in the current conflict?
Happily. I wonder if I could just for 1 second I'll make a comment about the way presented situation in the territories. I think that as commendable as AL's documentary effort in this catalog has been, and I think it's also long overdue for Israeli architects to contend with this question, I nevertheless think that to disavow the legacy of German architectural modernism and its planning traditions in Israel and Palestine as he's done is as ideological as adopting it as part of a national ethos. The reality is that the history of the development of the settlements bears out, in fact, a really interesting story that's quite opposite to the one that Eyal has just told. The settlers were, in no small measure, from the very beginning up until nearly now, been advancing a critique of Zionist socialist planning as a critique of a godless nationalism, as part of a fundamentally erroneous project that it was their mission to correct. And they would do so with a project of settlement that would not be based on precisely the kinds of methods of socialist state building that had been characteristic to Palestine during the so-called heroic period of colonization. So that the methodologies and the spatial practices for the creation of new towns and even tower and stockade settlements is in some regards fundamentally different, even though they might be morphologically similar to what has been taking place in the territories. I just wanted to point this out. In no small measure, I would suggest that what has been taking place in the territories and vis-a-vis the settlements is really not reducible to the utilization of architecture by the state as a political tool, as a strategic embellishment. In no small measure, I would strongly argue that the settlements represent as much a kind of form of internal revolt against the state and its policies historically as anything else. They have been, in fact, the sites where a majority of Israeli political internal divisions have played themselves out, from ethnic to religious to various forms of nationalism, and in fact they've always been pretty significantly ahead of the consensus of the political establishment about any policy, whether it's been a national unity government, a Likud-led government, or anyone else. So in this we differ, but if you'd like me to...
I agree with you, Dan.
Okay, you want to respond to that, Al Weissman?
I'll respond later, but I agree with this analysis.
Okay. All right, so let's do the history lesson.
Thank you. Well, I don't know exactly where one would begin such a history lesson except to suggest two things. First of all, the argument that veneration for holy sites, shrines, the Aqsa Mosque, etc., dates back, that the struggle over this city and this country emanates from ancient affiliations is an utterly modern argument, if I'm making myself clear. In effect, this is a relatively recent argument which has been elaborated principally since the 19th century and with the rise of evangelical geography. As for the very specific question of the Intifada al-Aqsa...
What do you mean by evangelical geography?
Well, in the 19th century, it became a common there was a large effort on the part of various European intellectuals to try and, in some measure, rediscover biblical sites of biblical importance by engaging in cartographic research in the Holy Land, so that a number of English, French, and German researchers would essentially go begin mapping. The Palestine Exploration Fund is one. There were many other such organizations, and they would begin to try to engage in what was called toponymic research, partly looking at geography, but also looking at the contemporary place names of sites in Ottoman Palestine, the names of Palestinian Arab villages, in order to try and, in some sense, tease out of those names the original biblical names for those sites.
Were these people motivated by scholarship or religious?
It was this remarkable amalgam of scholarship, religion, and imperial ideology that Edward Said has chronicled so effectively in his book Orientalism. It was really very much within the framework of what he once called imaginative geography, but also more than this, as I argue in the book. The argument about the Intifada al-Aqsa and the way in which, this shrine has participated in the current round of or cycle of mass violence is, I think, indicative of another phenomenon. What has happened principally since the time of the Mandate is that political actors on both sides of this conflict, Palestinian Arab and Jewish nationalist, Zionist in various forms, have essentially been forced to explain to anyone who demanded it of them in what way the mass violence that each side privileged as decisive moments of historical change, how this violence was in fact instigated. And both sides turned relatively quickly to claims for architecture for these holy sites. On one side, for example, principally swirling around the disturbances of 1929, which took place, which were called a Burak or Whaley Wall disturbances, what began to happen is that one side argued that the other instigated the masses to violence by making false claims about their own intentions to occupy them. In other words, the Zionists made the argument that the Palestinian Arab National Movement, principally a faction in it that were religious nationalists, had in effect attempted to had basically created propaganda that Jews intended to occupy those sites and in that way fomented violence. From the other side of the coin, when the Zionist National Movement in various forms accused the Palestinian Arab National Movement of practicing precisely this kind of instigation, the argument was turned back once again, suggesting that what was really happening is that by their insensitivity to Muslim and Arab sensitivities, Jews themselves had, in effect, triggered violence. What nobody really, in any sense, questioned was the relation between architecture and the possibility of instigating violence here. That was assumed and at face value. The book I've written is, in effect, a history of that argument, a history of that claim, the assertion of the self-evidence of the relation between architecture and mass violence, and it's been perpetuated into the present, this mode of arguing, as we've seen in 2000, and now currently that's beginning again with Rachel's Tomb.
Well, no, if you're going back to the period,
sure,
the decades ago, it's different now in that one side has F-16s and the other doesn't. I mean, how does that change
the
discourse?
It's absolutely true that one side has F-16s, but both sides are engaged. I guess what I would like to say is that the way in which both sides, in a context of mutual recrimination, make claims for how history happens here is less about one side having arms and one side not having enough arms, and more about arriving at a kind of collusive communicative framework among political elites. In what I'm trying to suggest is that there's utter complicity, though they don't pick up the phone and talk to one another, between Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat when it comes to this kind of a framework contest around privileged holy sites, Jerusalem, and the rest of it. They basically agree, in effect, to blame those who have never been offered peace in this conflict of rejecting peace in this conflict by virtue of the Jerusalem excuse. And so I'm not so sure that the relative weight of arms in this particular aspect of the conflict is a particular explanatory power. To the contrary, in one sense, what's happened here is that both sides privilege the instances of essentially communal violence, which are, you know, not with F-16s, as historically transformative. The end of Oslo, for example, in 2000, or the archaeological tunnel riots in 1996, or even 1929.
And is there
people
any,
with clubs?
Is there any way out of this destructive, discursive prison, or is it?
It's not my job in any sense to offer a prescription for how things should change. My scholarship is not geared towards any kind of policy relevant instrumental approach. Having said that, it would seem to me that the very first step in all of this would be to understand the history of precisely the way in which political actors in this conflict make claims for the self-evidence of what's going on around them. And in some degree, architecture occupies an incredibly important position at those moments. Everyone involved.
Now, is this do you think a general principle, or is this particular to this part of the world?
I'm not certain. I wouldn't want to make claims for other places. I would certainly think that the kind of framework of what sociologists have called strategic interaction, the framework of mutually assessed, mutual assessment concerning the instigation of violence, is not in any sense unique to this conflict. What is, I think, in some sense unique to this conflict is the claim for the uniqueness of these sites, if you see what I'm saying. In effect, the only thing that's unusual about this is the argument that it's unusual. And
well, there are not two places in the world that claim to be the birthplace of Jesus.
Yeah, that's fine. But that argument is a really new one, politically speaking. Uh-huh. And that's, in some sense, what I think it's very important to remember. This is not a self-evidently religious argument that it's the birthplace of Jesus or that Muhammad tethered his steed in front of the Burak before ascending to heaven during the famed Isra, or that this was the site of the Temple of Solomon. As a political argument, it's remarkably new, and it required a huge historical political effort to make it appear to be so transparent and self-evident that it's not contested by any party in this conflict.
That's the voice of Daniel Monk, who is the author of the book The Aesthetic Occupation, recently published by Duke University Press. And A.L. Weissman, any comments on anything that Daniel Monk said?
Yes, I think that what Dan was saying is very interesting. I think it's very much the question that almost could be kind of divided to the question of the subterrane and the terrain, or the question of archaeology. Zionism has always seen the what is under the surface in the Holy Land is the alibi. It's this kind of ancient cartography that has to be kind of dug out and brought to the surface was always used very, very politically. Archaeological digs, usually in Israel, up until very recently, were kind of discarding the upper levels. When you dig a mound, you go through kind of Ottoman Islamic layers that were usually kind of bulldozed away in search of the further, the deepest, deeper layers of Second Temples or Bronze Age, kind of the First and Second Temple phases, times. And I think that going back to the Temple Mount, it became a very, very specific question there that Israeli archaeologists and Israeli historians were claiming that the location of the temple was actually few, or let's say doesn't meter lower than the location of today's mosque. That was kind of brought them into a very complex discussion of kind of archaeological architecture. That claim became very important during the discussion in Camp David for the division, for the partition of Jerusalem, because Israel claimed that it should own the land underneath the mosque. And Clinton's very famous proposal for the Temple Mount and proposed the international boundary between Israel and Palestine, which is horizontal, which would give the Palestinians sovereignty over the mount, and the Israelis underneath it. So I think there is there's a whole kind of issues of kind of layers of history and of meaning that are organized like in palimpsest, like strata. That is very interesting to think about in relationship to this place. But as well to comment again on what Dan was saying, I think that Israel is now very privileged that it has almost absolute control on the way that space is organized. So whatever claims they are of the different parties, Israel has the ability to translate those claims to facts. And it's been consistently doing it in transferring, for example, the very famous, what is the so-called Tower of David, in the Old City, which used to be a mosque, kind of rename it as a site of Jewish history and kind of build a museum there, which kind of commemorates 3,000 years of Jewish presence in Jerusalem. So I think that, however, the claim couldn't be conflictual and almost equal, Israel has the ability and is doing it and is consistently reorganizing space in order to for it to function as almost as kind of as a sign bearing for you know, the kind of the return, the idea of the fact that there is an alibi for us, the Israelis coming back there.
I'm afraid the merciless clock tells us we're out of time, but thank you for joining us from Tel Aviv, where it's midnight, 12:30 now. Eyal Weissman, who was just speaking, yeah. And in the studio, Daniel Monk, who is the author of the book, An Aesthetic Occupation, The Immediacy of Architecture in the Palestine Conflict, recently published by Duke University Press. Thanks to both of you. Sorry, we don't have more time. And we'll be back in a moment with Hamid Davashi. Noisy interlude was a mix by the great DJ Paul Van Dyke, and we'll go out with a little more of him in a bit. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And I should say that the shows are now archived on my Left Business Observer website, so if you ever want to listen to any of them again. It usually takes me a day or two to get them up, but they will get there. And also some back interviews, back shows, individual interviews are also archived there. Go visit leftbusinessobserver.com, all one word, on the World Wide Web, www.leftbusinessobserver.com. And right in the front page there will be a link to the radio archives, which will tell you how to listen. And now I'm joined in the studio by Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor at Columbia University and named as one of the enemies of the Campus Watch folks. Tell us about your history with these
people.
So
you told me.
I think there's seven names listed on their website, and you're one of them. So
yeah.
Congratulations. You're doing something right.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you.
How did you get to this exalted status?
I have absolutely no idea. The story of it actually starts earlier, mid-June. I was away, I was in Japan for the World Cup, and came back, and I saw there were about 10 extremely obscene and racist and threatening voicemails on my telephone at Columbia in my office. And I thought, what was wrong? What did I do now? So finally I found out that there was this man, Daniel Pipes, I have no idea who he is, never met him, never read a word of his writings. Has written an article.
Raving right-wing military lunatic.
Yeah, that he has written an article against me, a whole group of other people, in New York Post, I believe, accusing me of all sorts of nonsensical things. And that had prompted these voicemails. I ignored them, but I sort of kept them intuitively on my voicemail and in the memory. But I ignored it and didn't pay attention until the last week of August. One day, it's a very crazy days for us, last week of August, first week of September, because of registration and so forth. And I chair my department. It's really a chaotic situation. I got up one morning and went to check my email, and it says you have 233 messages. So what madness is this? I open it and I see that the same article that this man had written against me was emailed to me 233 times, coming from various places, sent to various listservs, and with threatening subjects, your days are numbered, and then some obscene modulations with Arabic words or Palestinian references. To make a long story short, this was a harassment of disproportionate imagination. I mean, this made it impossible for me to run my do my duties as the chair of my department. Contacted Columbia Security, informed NYPD, and now they are pursuing it. Apparently, this I'm one of their target. These are some hackers that are targeting human rights activists and hacking their computers, flooding their emails, and making it impossible for them to communicate. Then they came and interviewed me. They taped those voicemails. They give them to the police and other authorities. And there are two now suits against them. They're pursuing them for two reasons: both harassment against me, harassment against Columbia, because they are making it impossible for me to do my duties as chairman. And this problem still continues because it's constantly they flood my email, and they have doubled my quota, but it's still the rapidity with which they are doing it is just maddening. And then the most recent development is this thing that this man has put a website, which is sort of cyberspace McCarthyism. And it's me and a number of other...
Yeah, they're encouraging students all over the country to rat
on
their professors.
Yes, to write on us and report on us. And I was very proud of the Chronicle of Higher Education that immediately they called me, within hours they called me and chatted with me to alert the academic community, because this is quite serious. It poisons the atmosphere, especially for young academics who are very conscious about their status and authority and presence in classrooms, and makes it extremely difficult for them to create a healthy and congenial atmosphere of debate and conversation, as all classrooms ought to be. Classrooms are the sites of cultivating critical judgment of our environment. This
and
is
of course,
our
younger
duty.
Professors are untenured.
Exactly.
And their
anxiety
is very
over tenure.
Rocky.
Exactly. Exactly. So senior professors like me is really a silly thing to do, and has absolutely no effect, because contrary to these dumb-witted nobodies who have established their reputation by these sorts of atrocities, the academic and scholarly credentials of people like me is established over a long period of time and is not going to be discredited by this nonsense. In fact, quite to the contrary, because of this, so from my older professors from University of Pennsylvania to my older students, they have followed this and called me and asked me what they can do. I had a splendid conversation with Jacques Berlinebra, one of my former students when I used to teach at NYU. He called me this morning and said, "Professor Dabashi, this is Jacques Berlinebra, your former student." I said, "Jacques, how are you? What's happening?" He said, "I'm now a professor at Hofstra University." I said, "Great, good to hear from you. What's happened?" He said, "Well, I used to defend you against monarchists. Now I have to defend you against Jews." I said, "No, it has nothing to do with Jews." From Hanan Hever, one of the most distinguished Peace Now Movement activists in Israel, to Bruce Robbins, my colleagues here, they're all on my side. These people's claim to Judaism is as valid as Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden's claim to Islam, or BJP activist thugs in India to Hinduism. It has nothing to do with... at one level extremely silly, but yet another level quite serious when you think of the atmosphere of fear and intimidation that they hope to generate. And in some cases, not in my case, certainly not in my case, but in some cases of younger professoriate, can be quite serious.
All right, let's turn to the real reason you're here. It's just a coincidence that this news broke on the same day you were scheduled to be at the show.
Yeah.
Well, first, let's talk about you're from a country now identified by our president as a member of the Axis of Evil. How
does
that feel?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a silly, unbelievable. I hear there was a Canadian journalist who came up with this term, Axis of Evil. And I'm putting together, in fact, these people who write these things against me would probably like to know that. I'm putting together...
I hope they're listening.
I doubt if they listen to you, Doc. I wish they were. Putting an event on Iraq, in fact, which is now far more of my immediate concern than Iran. Of course, Iran is also, I'm concerned. But Iraq is the more immediate point of danger. I'm putting an event at Colombia very soon, sort of a teach-in, which I'm calling it Accessing, not as playing on access, accessing the evil. Namely, an attempt to put a human face on who are these 22 million Iraqis and what has happened to half a million Iraqi kids who have starved to death. And I'm inviting, physicians, for example, who have followed these things about the starvation of kids in Iraq, to archaeologists who are following what is happening to, I mean, these don't belong to Iraq only. The Mesopotamian civilization is such a massive significance for the rest of humanity. And because of the American and allied so-called bombing over the last decade, permanent damage has been done to these archaeological sites, and I'm having a very distinguished archaeologist to talk about these things. So it's an attempt, a conscious raising about putting a human face on this axis of evil. What do I feel? When it comes to the Iranian side, it is quite serious, extremely serious. I have one of the most distinguished feminist activists, Iranian, now as my guest that I have invited for this film conference that my colleague Richard Pena and I put together in Lincoln Center in Colombia. Shahla Loyeji is my guest. And I've had now 2 days of constant conversation with him, what's happening in the reform movement, in the progressive movements that are facing with these horrible mullahs for a decade after the death of Khomeini, trying to establish a modicum of democratic institutions. They are, Doc, horrified of the possibility of a U.S. attack against Iraq, because they have been told in no uncertain terms all the progressive elements within the Iranian society. Should United States attack Iran, they will all be subject to immediate harassment, put back to jail. And the entire post-Khatami development, inch by inch establishing institutions of democracy, will be wiped out. It's a very precarious situation. Two branches of the government, the presidency and the parliament, are not entirely democratic. Khatami's claim to legitimacy as a president is far more to Bush's claim to legitimacy as a president. We have no right to think that this is a cradle of democracy and we are spreading democracy to the world. No. Khatami is far more democratically elected, more than 75% of the vote, and there is no Florida situation.
No dimple chads in Iran.
But I would go so far as suggesting that the dangerous conditions that these warmongers have created around the world, so far as Iran is concerned, the implication of it is exactly like 1953, when Kermit Roosevelt arranged for a coup and toppled the democratically elected. You remember last time we talked about the government of Mossadegh and brought back Shah to power. That now the precarious situation that we have in Iran, with the religious right barely holding power and eliminating any possibility of successful democratization of Iran, which is a model. I spent last summer in much of the Arab world. Iranian experimentation with democracy is now a model for much of the region as potentially achieving democratic institutions, but it's extremely fragile. Extremely fragile. Khatami is very, very weak. The constitution gives overwhelming power to this so-called rahbar, the leader, the religious figure. And responsible people want to achieve change without bloodshed, without bringing the kids into the street, as happened the summer of 1999 when we had a major student uprising. So they are trying to do these changes without any bloodshed, but the religious right is relentless in holding to power, and they are economically sort of founded and based on power.
When you were here last, late last year, I think, it looked like Iran has a rather young population. It was entirely sick of being run by a bunch of clerics.
And
it looked like things were tending in a better direction from our point of view.
Yeah.
What's all this Bush war drum beating done for the situation?
Worsen it. I mean, there are the democratic movement. Right now, a number of leading dissident activists, people like Nouri, people like Ganji, these names in the United States don't mean anything because we don't follow it closely, but there is a group of dissident activists who, because of their activities and their opposition to this theocracy, are in jail. But the manifestos and writings that they write and are published still, with all the crackdown on the press they are published, clearly is outlining a program of democratic developments beyond Khatami. That is, Khatami, after two terms of presidency, has done his services, and they have stonewalled him. They cannot allow him to do more. Economically and in terms of institutionalization of democracy. So we have an outline of what needs to be done. Issues such as civil disobedience is now very, very carefully articulated and planned out by way of resistance to this theocracy. But suddenly, when after October 7, when war in Afghanistan started, of course, suddenly being in the neighborhood of Afghanistan, the country assumes a posture of a defensive posture. And as soon as a country is in a defensive posture, they're all the, whatever limited smidgen of democratic institutions are secured, they all go down the drain. Right now, the reformist movement, the most progressive elements within the Iranian opposition, I would identify the Iranian political culture in three terms. One is this: the mullahs were in charge of power and the government and the military and the security forces. Then the government, which is the oddity, Iran, Khatami's government is in a position of opposition. That is the opposing element. But there is a third.
He's the president, but he's in opposition.
Exactly, it's the weirdest thing ever. But that's
so the clerics part. Really run the executive.
They are running the judiciary, but through the judiciary and through the manipulation of the judiciary branch, the executive and the legislative is completely democratic, but the judiciary is exclusively in their hands. And then there are these monkey wrenches in the constitution, such as the supervisory board, that they manipulated and they prevent any democratic changes, for example, in press laws. But the movement that is now emerging, beginning with summer of 1999, student uprising, is post-Khatami, what will happen after Khatami, that is very serious concentration that on the fact that the revolution has lost its legitimacy. Books, films, documentaries, culture is always ahead of these things. There is a massive body of evidence produced in art, literature, essays, press is at the forefront of this,
that the revolution has lost its ideological and political legitimacy. These people have absolutely no claim, no authority, no legitimacy to what were the ideals of the revolution when it was launched between 1977 and 1979. And as a result, this impasse has to come to an end and a way out articulated. But now, after this sort of a lull period in the Afghani war situation, the possibility of war with Iraq has petrified them, because again, the religious hooligans, the functional equivalents of Daniel Pipes and his thuggeries here, are now again up in arms. They are in the streets. They disrupt any sort of political, social, even cultural gatherings. So there is a state of siege again dominating the circumstances. People are holding their breath. They don't know what will happen.
I speak with Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor at Columbia University and an author of a book on Iranian film from Versa, whose title I can't remember now, right?
Close Up.
Okay. Yeah. We're running low on time, so let's... what do you think Bush's motives are? I mean, he talks about democratizing the Middle East, but it looked like Iran was well on the way towards democratizing itself without any help from Washington. I'm generally skeptical of, you know, it's all about oil explanations, because they seem to be kind of vulgar and oversimplified.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this case, it's kind of tempting to conclude that it
sure,
really is all about oil.
Sure.
What do you think Bush is up to?
I think, Doug, that we need a far more critical and careful analysis of what is happening. And we will be wrong in only concentrating, okay, there was the Taliban and Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, so we did Afghanistan. Then there is Saddam Hussein and all his criminal activities in Iraq, now it's Iraq. I think something different is happening. That is, the process we call globalization, which is really a wild horse. Nobody is in charge, no country, no nation, no World Bank, no WTO, nothing is in charge. In my judgment, what we're witnessing today is a very amazing development in terms of the very definition of the state. You remember when Wolfowitz said that we're going to end states in fight against terrorism? I think the fight against terrorism is in fact a blueprint for remodulation of the very idea of the United States as an empire. And the remodulation, which is a sort of an amorphous empire without boundaries. I mean, the classical empires, right, the British Empire. You know where the boundaries of the British empires are and where the colonies are. But no longer in the age of globalization and the way that the capital has mutated and amorphized itself, can any state be in charge of the capital. The events, for example, in Latin America, in Venezuela, this notion of axis of evil, suddenly putting Iran and Iraq and North Korea. I mean, there is no logic to this. It doesn't make any sense.
There's no way they're on an axis, really.
Exactly. I mean, it's just the weirdest thing. But I tend to take these things seriously. The only way that you can think of this as seriously, and not dismiss them, these are just idiots who come up with these phrases, is really beginning to reconfigure the planet. Reconfigure the planet in a way that the United States as a metamorphized state can be in charge of the metamorphized capital. And in this sense, unification of Europe, for example, is a very critical, because it's now creating a massive market, one monetary unit, in order to compete with the United States as another monetary unit. United States is not in charge of globalization, but because of the weight of its economic weight, power, it can sort of shake the boat more than other economic factors within globalization. So militarily, I think that the United States is mutating into a global empire. And to be able to fight at the same time in multiple fronts. And again, militarily, and in terms of the new armaments that are developing, that there are these smart bombs. I mean, I don't know the proper language, but I just read in Jane's report that you can send a cruise missile towards a particular target in Mazar-e-Sharif to destroy it. And then because of the smart bomb, the cruise missile is so smart that can detect that target has already been hit report back that fact to wherever it is that it was launched, and then change its course and go back somewhere else and destroy some other high school in Afghanistan. These multiple front war abilities, which in effect, United States as an empire is modulating itself on guerrilla warfare, the way that now fight with terrorism, this phantasmagoric conception of Al-Qaeda has become, in fact, a model of warfare by an empire. So whatever conception we have of Al-Qaeda, multiply it with whatever infinity number you know, that becomes the way that this notion of empire has to have been militarily able to control this, what we call globalization.
And I'm afraid, once again, we're out of time, and with you it's always too short. Thanks for joining us, Hamid Dabashi, who is professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University, and also author of the book on Iranian film called Close Up, which Verso published a while back. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news now until the evening, and let's go out with a little more of this from Paul Van Dyke.